guys. K2 Romeo India Whiskey here. My name is Dick. And I'm wondering why I'm hearing a hissy signal.
Yes, we had it also.
Yeah, I think one of the normal inputs to the machine may be turned off. What you guys are listening to is TechNet number 1457 of the series that began in 1982. TechNet is therefore a little bit more than 30 years old, and for those 30 years what guys have been doing is coming together and discussing their favorite subject, ham radio. The TechNet in the beginning used to be 1 hour from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and then people started complaining that, gee, that wasn't enough time, and it became 2 hours and 3 hours, and nowadays, for the last 6 years, it's a four-hour thing. The TechNet begins at 8 o'clock and ends at noon, here we go, at midnight. Let me drop. And in that period of time, the TechNet, over those 30 years, has slowly evolved. The way we've set up the menu these days, what the menu has evolved into, is that for the first hour, we take questions of a general nature, ham radio-wise, and try to give people at least a brief answer during the first hour. And sometimes when it comes to that brevity, Hal, K6TPZ, has recently been giving us examples of what a brief answer is like. As I said, rarely does a person have to wait more than an hour, a little bit more than an hour, for his question to be answered, at least in a somewhat simple manner. The next thing on the menu is that John, KC2WGB, gives us the mailbag responses. In other words, people who don't yet have their ham license, let me drop. People who don't yet have their ham license or don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us live, they send John a snail mail, an email, whatever, carrier pigeon, with that question. And I've gotten a little bit of a hint of one of the very good questions. We've gotten a nice scientific question was asked to John this week, and I got a little bit of a forewarning last night as to what's coming. So that could be kind of interesting. But that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who gives us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. I might also, at the end of that, give you guys a little bit of some of the statistics about the Large Hadron Collider. John and I had a discussion on that topic last night, and we suddenly realized that some of that information is pretty striking. After that, then we go into deeper subjects. There are people who don't like the deeper subjects. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. Starting at roughly 10 o'clock or so, if you don't want to listen to that, you don't have to. There are people who try to control the TechNet and say they don't want the deep technical subjects discussed. And so there's 800 channels on your rig. You can tune at another time, at another frequency during that time. The technical net tries to give an immediate responses to people. By that I mean it's a give-and-take live discussion. We try to tap into the fact that there's a large amount of brain power in the tri-state area, northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York, and at least western Long Island and portions of eastern Long Island is where this repeater and its linking systems have a connection to. And so when a person, let me drop. When a person in one of those areas has experience in one of the areas that we're discussing, one of the subjects that we're discussing, we welcome them to chime in saying that, hey, I've done that, and this is my experience. This is what worked, and this is what didn't work. No guarantee that everything you're going to hear is 100% accurate at first. There's a kind of peer review going on because for the last 6.5 years, a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has been recording the TechNet and putting it on a website. And therefore, by way of that peer review, people will listen to those recordings and say, yeah, gee, you guys said such and such, and it really is so and so, and we get a chance to correct it. Every realistic engineer has to admit the fact that he never is going to be right all of the time. Nobody bats a thousand. A realistic engineer knows that he's going to have a certain amount of errors a certain percentage of the time, and he accepts that. He has no choice. You can try to convince everybody you've never made an error, and I've met a few people like that, and they live in my... In my opinion, they live a fairly frustrated life in that process. Let me drop. We should try to wait for all four beeps and 1 or 2 seconds beyond. because this machine also has connection by way of IRLP and Echo Link to other machines across the United States and some other countries. We sometimes even get a report from KQUPS, Rich, as he's driving through the Midwest with by various techniques. He signs into the TechNet. And so anybody can join us. And so we're going to try to wait long enough periodically so that some of the people in the outer areas get a chance to sign in. Some of that equipment occasionally takes a little bit longer to be reset. Okay, that's the menu. We're going to take check-ins right now for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. We need not need you to sign in just to say that you're listening. After 30 years, I believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us. In the early days, let me drop. In the early days, we would waste the first half hour with long lists of people signing in saying they're listening. And that's not quite what people really want to hear. Radio and wireless techniques are very poorly taught in the schools and only mediocrely taught, in my opinion, in some of the books. And so if you really want somebody who understands how radio works, most likely you've got to hire a ham radio operator. Because the way we teach that in our colleges, I know there's a lot of room for improvement. As I interview students coming right out of the school with a good bachelor degree and a good high scholastic index, sometimes a master's degree, and you ask them questions about whether or not they could design an antenna, even though they've been specializing in wireless communications, and the answer is no. And that's a very sad situation because you can have a gold-plated receiver and transmitter and a platinum-plated transmission line, if you know what I mean. Top-of-the-line equipment everywhere. If you don't connect it to a good transmitting antenna, and if the receiver is not connected to a good receiving antenna, you've got nothing. If you don't believe that, climb to the top of your tower, disconnect the transmission line at the antenna, and then try to go on the air. You'll rapidly find out the antenna is everything. You could say, if you're a serious wireless person, you start off with a good antenna in a good location first, and then you hang some electronics onto it. The commercial equivalent of that, or the military electronic equivalent of that, let me drop it, is that every airborne radar starts off with a darn good antenna with very low side lobes that are looking at the Earth, a very good radome in front of it on that airplane so that the antenna can look with transparency into the clear sky out in front of it. You start off with a darn good antenna, and very good ways of steering it, very good control of the side lobes. Then you hang the electronics onto it that makes it to a radar. You do it the other way around, and you're probably doomed to a disaster. And I've seen a few of those. I've watched a company go down the tubes who for 50 solid years had been manufacturing radars, and all of a sudden they got into a major project where, because of some mismanagement, all the concentration was on the electronics, and at the tail end, with a little bit of time left over, they tried designing the antenna and installing it on the airplane. They spent the next 2 or 3 years troubleshooting that system, and it never became a product because the antenna didn't have it. So antennas, as I said, are very poorly taught in the schools. The ham radio operators are the guys who build antennas with their own hands, tinker with them, fiddle with them in the backyard, up in the trees, on top of the house, on top of the tower, talk to their friends with it. I've tried a such-and-such antenna, or I've tried a so-and-so antenna, this is the one that works, and his friends, in the process of talking back to him, give him the information to tweak the darn thing and make it work well. So you can see where I feel, my feeling on that particular subject. Okay, give me your call letters right now, and your name, because you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign, it would sound like this. WA2PJF, Vito, and yes. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
WA2PJF, Vito, yes.
WA2RAS, Jeff, yes.
Ontario, NJGN.
Hey, reverse order.
So from Toronto, a quick question. Not a tech question, but a net question.
Okay, somebody who said net question, I'm going to come back to you in a minute. In the order in which I heard the sign-ins, Vito, PJF, Jeff, Romeo, Alpha, Sierra, I believe, West, N2XJN, the person with a net question, give me your call letters and go ahead with your net question, sir.
Is there an chat room that runs concurrent with this net? That was my question. The E3JIW.net.
Okay, I think it was the E3JIW. I think that's Jim. And is there a chat net that runs concurrent with this net? The person who would know that is Bernie, K2YO, Eric, KE2EJ, NY2H, Lou. If one of those guys, with all the smarts of the system, are there, please give me your call letters right now with possibly that answer for Jim.
Who's that, I2H? Hold on.
We hear you, Lou. Go right ahead.
Apart from the Echolink chat, so those folks on Echolink can use the chat window that the company uses Echolink, we don't really have a chat section at this time. It's a good idea, though. We do have a reflector for the club, Limark Inc., on Yahoo, typically that's those things are moderated. As far as a chat room, no, but we could probably set one up if there was enough interest in Y2H.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you, Lou, and then Jim, in that order. Do you believe if there was enough interest that you believe that you being one of the directors of Limark, Long Island Amateur Radio Club, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, which is the sponsor of this particular repeater, you being one of the directors could possibly talk the rest of the directors into that if there was sufficient interest. And you being a computer maven from way back, you'd probably be able to give us a rough estimate that if it was reviewed in a positive manner, could that possibly take place in a month? It's a kind of a question there for you, listen. NY2H, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Otherwise, I just don't know how many people do not have Echolink. That was all.
Yeah, it's NY2A, Chad. I kill the receivers on the other side for a second so I can get in. Yeah, put the board, and probably, as long as we have a server, I'll talk to Bernie. Maybe we can use his server and set up a chat. Let me get back to you, and we'll see what we can do. I don't know how it would work. I guess people would talk amongst themselves in the chat room while you're conducting the net. Dick, it might be another window you'd want to be looking at, or perhaps John. Maybe John could monitor it, and then if a question comes up or something, he could jump in. Anyway, we'll look at Y2H.
Very fine, Lou, and I thank you for that information. There are various people who send me emails not respond to those because I run for duplex, which means I'm working on the out of the machine at the same time. I'm running full duplex, which means I'm listening to what comes out of the machine while I'm running the net. I use the internet by way of QRZ.com in order to figure out people's names, because I like referring to people by their first name when I pass it back to them. And some people forget to give me the name when they check in. I also listen on the input during the time that somebody is transmitting. Occasionally somebody will forget to turn on the PL tone, 136.5, if they're local to the New York City area, and therefore they're not coming through the machine, and I'm hearing them on the input frequency. So I'm kind of busy, and therefore people who send me emails or people who want me to chat with them at the same time, I might not be able to handle that, although maybe with some training I could. And let's see now, when it comes to the sign-ins, we did get Joe, R-Y-Y, and then Don, AA2. The first person with a question was Vito, WA2PJF. Go right ahead, Vito, K2LIW in the 10-9.
RFI@LIMOC.org.
Stand by for a second. area, giving quite a bit of grief. And so, as the bunny hunters search him down, we'll have a little bit of a delay. K2IIW in the TechNet.
Thank you.
and you put a broadband 50 ohm resistor at the far end, and the cable was good cable in good condition. At the input end, you're going to measure 50 ohms at all reasonable frequencies. And when you use an ohm meter to measure through the transmission line with a 50 ohm resistor at the far end, a 50 ohm dummy load, that is a necessary but not sufficient. Now, there's a zillion ways that a transmission line can develop grief. It can have a squeezed portion where somebody ran an automobile over it, so to speak, where there's a chunk of the transmission line that is some other impedance because it's been squeezed down from the outside to the inside, but not bad enough to create a short circuit between the center conductor and the shield. Water can get into the coax cable. Contamination can get into it. Old-fashioned coax, which had a polyethylene-like outer jacket, would contaminate the polyethylene. The dielectric would be contaminated by the polyvinyl chloride, poorly made stuff on the outside. So there's a lot of ways a coaxial cable can give you a failure at RF frequencies, even though with an ohm meter, sand conductor seems to be doing its job, coaxial, the shield seems to be doing its job, and you'll measure 50 ohms through it into a dummy load. But because you didn't put the vector network analyzer on the input end of the transmission line and sweep it with the dummy load or with the antenna, that's the next step that I think would have given you the information. Out of curiosity, when you finally found out what was going on, what was the failure there, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
This is actually some previously used 9915, which I lent to the club to use for the downlink at the Cleveland Aviation. And as you can imagine, it didn't come back the same way it came off the roll. Well, actually, I did put the VNA on it, and it really looked ragged. But I cheated. What I did was I kept trimming the cable until I got somewhere close, so I got the minimum of reflections and the forward power going where I wanted it. So it was a cheat. But then again, when I think of how we do in the broadcast line, we actually try to make the transmission line between the transmitter and the antenna an exact even wavelength of the frequency in question. Control WK2 again.
When you, there are a large number of amateurs out there who believe that your transmission line must be an exact multiple electronically of a wavelength or a half wavelength, and any other length of transmission line will not work well. That is much too severe a requirement in my opinion. There's a slight advantage in having the transmission line an exact multiple of a wavelength or exact multiple of a half wavelength. Let me think about that. Half wave? Yeah, half wave. An exact multiple of a half wave or one wave. The advantage is, if the line is relatively low in loss, whatever impedance you put at the far end is the exact same impedance you measure at the input end, if the line is low in loss. So it repeats impedance. If you put a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna at the far end, which has a particular phase angle of reflection coefficient, at the input end, if it's an even number of half wavelengths of transmission line, you'll measure that exact impedance, the exact same dot on the Smith chart, so to speak, the same phase angle of reflection. It repeats. If by comparison, let me drop it. If by comparison, you have an odd number of quarter wavelengths of transmission line, 1/4 wave, 3/4 wave, 5/4 wave, then it's an impedance inverter. An impedance inverter is one of the really crazy characteristics of a transmission line that the first time you hear it, you say, hey, this range is in friction. Put 50 ohms at the far end, you'll measure 50 ohms at the input end. That's good, 50 ohm cable. Put 25 ohms at the far end, it's a 2-to-1 visuar. You measure 100 ohms at the input end. Still a 2-to-1 visuar, but the opposite kind of impedance. Low impedance on the far end will give you a high impedance on the near end, and vice versa. It impedance inverts. A capacitor at the far end will look like an inductor on the rear end. It inverts reactance, it inverts resistance if it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. So, because you might want to use the right kind of instrumentation in the shack and get a good strong clue as to what the exact impedance of your antenna is today, as it sucks up water and snow and ice and whatever, then there's a slight advantage of having an even number of quarter waves, or another way of looking at it is an exact number of half waves of transmission line. That's the advantage. But there are guys who think that the standing wave ratio bridge and their bird watt meter will not correctly tell them forward power and reverse power if they don't have the magic length of transmission line. And they think the antenna is going to do all kinds of failure mechanisms if they don't have an exact length of transmission line. In most situations, in my opinion, that's much too severe a requirement. I wonder if this is sort of what you're getting at, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW. 6DTZ with a comment.
Yeah, okay, Howard. Yeah, I'll give it back to Dick and then you pick it up. Actually, I use a TVR function, and I actually found the bad part of the cable and chopped it out and put a little slice in there. Although, they really wrecked the cable, so I don't think about the cable as really being a device which is supposed to have a constant capacitance across its length. Whereas if you were to take a piece of cable and look at it as a cross-section, it's really sort of like a line of capacitors lined up between the center conductor and the outer shield. And when the distance between the two of them starts to change, we start to get some capacitive reactance, and then it becomes a little more of a tuned circuit. K2RW, K2J.
On a quick break, Eric, what was the nature of the failure? Had the center of the transmission line been run over with a vehicle and partially crushed? The section that you had to replace, is that approximately what had happened to it?
No, let's call it a kink. 9913 is it's not a foam dielectric, it's a solid, it's a semi-air dielectric. And it really doesn't like to be messed around with much, so, the cable was run up to the roof and then eventually wound up again, and they didn't really do a very nice job of it, and it got twisted in a few places.
Very fine, Eric. Now, Hal, K60PZ, you and I have had a number of discussions of magic lengths of transmission lines, and we did have a degree of disagreement on that subject at one time. And I suddenly realized that which one of us is right, to a certain degree, we're both right. And about 3 weeks ago, I did give a report on that. Under certain conditions, length of the transmission line will change the exact VISWAR that you'll measure in the shack. K60PZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Al.
K2LIW in the TechNet, K60PZ. Okay, first I want to say hi to everybody on the TechNet. I'm only here till 9, but I wanted to make one good comment. If the terminated impedance, be it reactive or resistive, at the end of a coax is the right perfect impedance, the length of cable, if the coax impedance matches the terminated impedance, resistive or reactance, doesn't matter how long the cable is. The only factor we enter in is the amount of power loss in the cable from the drive end to the load end. Back to you, Dick. K6DPZ with a short answer.
And are you curious about under what conditions the magnitude of the standing wave ratio can be made to go high and low as you change the length of a good piece of cable? Are you curious about that one, Hal? Go ahead.
Now, the only thing I'm saying is if you have a pure resistive or reactive load at the load end, at the same impedance as the line, doesn't matter how long the line is, the only thing you're going to have is a loss of power at the other end. That's my only comment. If you don't have a proper terminated impedance, then you're going to have a situation where your standing wave is going to be present, and you have to play with length to get the standing wave down at the driving end. That's my comment. K6DPZ. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, that was the exact statement that you made with reference to length changing the standing wave ratio. That if you choose a magic length, you can make the standing wave ratio become a very low number. And I was disagreeing with you on that one. There is one place where that is true. That is, if you're not using the right kind of a balancing device, at, say, for instance, a dipole, where Mother Nature wants the dipole to really be a balance, at the instant you connect your center conductor to the right side of the dipole and the shield to the left side with no balance, if you do that, which is a kind of quick and dirty technique, you will be launching signal back down the outside of the transmission line. Therefore, the length of the transmission line is part of the antenna. It's part of the radiating system. And as you change the length of the transmission line, you're changing the radiation length, you're changing the resonance, and it goes in and out of resonance a certain length of transmission line because the transmission line is part of the antenna, and now the visual goes up and down. If the proper balance was there, so that the transmission line is being fed, the antenna is being fed in a thoroughly balanced manner. Let me drop.
So I have a comment that you didn't understand, Dick.
You said it over and over again. If it's a pure 50 ohm load at the far end, you'll see nothing but a pure 50 ohm load in the input end. That's step number one. Go ahead, Al.
Station of the coax, be it resistive or reactive, 50 ohms. I didn't say a dipole, I didn't say a ground plane, I didn't say a Yagi. I was talking about the cable. The methods of feeding, a balanced antenna, yes, balance. That was not coming into this conversation. You're changing the conversation, Dick.
And I'm changing the conversation, Hal, for a very good reason. And this is one of the areas very many people misunderstand, that if you have the right kind of a balance at the far end, then the antenna, no matter what it is, what kind of a mismatch you got at the far end of the transmission line, which creates a certain amount of reflected power ratio, that reflected power ratio does not change when you change the length of a low-loss transmission line. Therefore, the VISWR does not change if a balance is present. That's where you and I have a bit of a disagreement on this one, Nahal. K60PZ, K2RIW.
2RIW, K60PZ. I was talking about terminated load. We weren't even talking about antenna right now. Terminated load, be it reactive or resistive. I wasn't discussing antenna, Dick. You're throwing antenna into the mixture, okay?
Okay. Let's assume now that I put a terminated load, a shielded load at the far end, which is not perfect. Let's assume that it's a 25 ohm load resistor, for instance, 2-to-1 VISWR. If I've got a 2-to-1 VISWR resistive load, a 25 ohm terminated load at the far end, are you telling me that the input VISWR will go up and down as I change the length of the transmission line? K6DPZ, K2LAW.
It will go up and down depending on the length of the added length into the line. K2LAW, K6DPZ. Let's not make it a personal debate. I'm sure a lot of other people also want to ask questions. Or you want to keep this going until 9 o'clock when I have to check out.
Okay, Hal doesn't want to discuss it at this time, so we'll discuss it some other time. I disagree with that statement. When you put a terminated load that's a mismatch on the far end, you get a certain amount of reflected power. The amount of reflected power does not change as a function of length of line. The reflected power ratio, the reflected voltage ratio, that's what gives you the magnitude of the VISWR. Therefore, the length of the transmission line in that circumstance will not change the VISWR, is what I'm saying. Hal is saying the opposite. You're getting two points of view here. Someday we'll get to the bottom of that. I did hear K2YZ on the input, but because of a lack of a PL tone, I think you're not coming through the machine. K2YZ, you wanted to say something on this? K2LIW? Sir? Now there's a transmission going on the input. We have to wait until he finishes. K2IZ, that was on the input. K2RIW. menial tone. You're not coming through the machine. Therefore, everyone else has to sit and wait. On top of that, there are a number of people who signed in before you. I can't just simply jump to your question now. The way you signed in, I thought you were giving us a comment on the subject that's on the floor at this time. So, Mr. Ized, I'll have to come back to you later. Okay, now that we're back into essentially normal operation, Vito, if you're still there, W2PJF, why don't you give us a transmission right now, Vito? K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay. The next person who signed in was Jeff, W2 Romeo Alpha Sierra. Are you there, Jeff? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, K2RIW on the TechNet. This is W2RIS. Interestingly, my question kind of dovetails with the discussion so far. Would you like to hear it?
We're now taking questions in the order in which they signed in. You were a valid sign-in person, Jeff. And no matter what your question is right now, we're going to take it. You got it, Jeff.
Okay, very good. This is interesting, I hope, because I do have the answer to the problem. I just don't understand why it works. So I guess I'm asking for trouble here. Years ago, I put up a halfway 40-meter inverted V dipole. It would not load. Even with a tuner, the SWR would not come down at all. It was astronomical. I don't remember why, but I tried putting a one-to-one ballon right at the output of my tuner, right? At the output of the tuner, a one-to-one ballon going up to the 40-meter dipole, and it worked fine, and it still does. My question is, why does it work? I know that's not the way you're supposed to do it. K2RIW, WA2RAS.
That's kind of fascinating, Jeff. Now, there's a number of ambiguities here. Was the transmission line a coaxial cable? A ballon, there's kinds of one-to-one ballons which are intended to feed twin lead, so to speak. And maybe your transmission line was twin lead. But if it was a thoroughly shielded one-to-one ballon, somewhat like these Unidella or N2, I can't think of the name, W2YU, I can't think of the guy's call letters right now, but there's a kind of balloning-like device. It's a white PVC tube, or I guess three-quarters of a foot long, a couple of inches in diameter. It's got nice eyebolts at the end where you connect the dipole to. It's got another eyebolt in the center where you can hang it from, and a SO239 on the bottom of it. That particular kind of a ballon will not, it's a kind of an RF choke on the outside of the cable. It will not let RF energy flow down the outside of the cable. And we typically put that at the antenna end. Now, to connect one of those devices at the input end, where it only has one coaxial connector, and it doesn't have a pair of coaxial connectors, therefore, to connect it between the output of a tuner and the input of a coaxial transmission line would be difficult. So, what was your transmission line? What did that ballon look like? Need a couple more words there, Jeff. WA2RAS, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Good question. First of all, it was I used coaxial cable. I believe it was RGAU. It is RGAU. And the ballon is not that kind. It's a one-to-one ballon. It has SO239s on both ends, so it was easy enough to go. The ballon is connected directly into the tuner, and then the antenna feed line, the RGAU, is connected to the ballon. And I know that this is not where it's supposed to go, but it works fine. Yeah, the SWR, you know, it comes right down with the tuner. It's flat with the tuner, but without the ballon, it's astronomical, even with the tuner. Back to you.
Is
DPZ with a fast comment before I go.
Okay, go ahead, Howard. It's on the subject.
On the subject, maybe, Jeff, that was a 4-to-1 balance, and you didn't even realize it, or it may have been mismarked as a 4-to-1, and then you would be able to have a possible match on a high VSWR feed line. Go ahead, Dick. I got it on.
Okay, bye-bye, Hal. Any chance, like Hal was saying there, Jeff, that you thought it was a 1-to-1 balance, and it could have been a 4-to-1? Is that a possibility?
Good, but no. It is definitely a 1-to-1 balun. It's clearly marked. I bought it as a 1-to-1. It's marked the 1-to-1 balun. It is not a 4-to-1 balun. And I have two of them. In other words, you know, I have multiple, many transmitters here, and several tuners. And so, you know, I repeated the situation, you know. In other words, I bought another one. So it's not a one-time fluke. It's a two-time fluke. Back to you, Dick.
I'm in, Dick.
Yes, stand by a second, John. Jeff, please tell us what is the brand name on that balun, and if you happen to know the model number. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, I'm looking at one. I hope I can see it here. It's looks like it's 1-915 RF isolator. It says on one of them, and give me 20 seconds, and I got to put the mic down, and I'll look at the other one, which is connected to a different tuner. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, 1-915 RF isolator. That sounds like a model number. Kind of curious what the brand name on that is. Wonder if you've ever run a SNP like this, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Late second.
Well, Dick, ran into something similar to that, KC2WGB. With the balun located at the transceiver, now that transmission coax line becomes part of the tune structure, that might be part of it.
It sure does. If you're doing a direct connection to the inverted V, center conductor going to the right side of the inverted V dipole and shield going to the second side, left side, and because of the way the dipole always wants to act like a balanced load, it's going to relaunch some of that signal back down on the outside of the cable. The cable is now part of the radiator. By way of this isolator that Jeff put in, he now is not grounding the bottom end. Ordinarily, the transmitter end is usually grounded by way of your 110-volt power connector, your 240-volt power connector, your ground rods you put there, whatever. There's a whole bunch of ways in which the transmitter end, the shack end, is grounded. And so by way of the balun there, you've RF-wise floated the bottom end of the coax. Now it can become an efficient radiator. That's a very good guess, John. It turns out that to get a really, really high standing wave ratio out of an inverted V that's approximately the right length at a reasonable altitude, that's unusual. If someone told me it's got a 1.8-to-1 standing wave ratio, I'd believe it. But if the standing wave ratio was so high that it was way outside of the range of a good antenna tuner. Let me drop. And that is what Jeff is saying. It was way outside of the range of the antenna tuner. That implies, I don't know the exact number, that he had an 8-to-1 standing wave ratio, so to speak. Most antenna tuners, regardless of what they're rated for, can go at certain phase angles, certain lengths of cable, they can go to extremely high standing wave ratios and give you a good match. An 8-to-1 is possible. And so to make an inverted V that bad, there'd have to be something like a complete open circuit or a complete short circuit somewhere in the system, like however the mechanical junction took place at the transmission line, the coax 50 ohm cable to the inverted V, and the way it's mechanically suspended. You'd have to have a direct short circuit, or one side of the dipole would have to be laying against the downspout tubing or the antenna gutters the house, something, you know, fairly extreme, because that's such a reliable antenna to, if it's approximately the right length. Now, if it was an 80-meter dipole and you're feeding it on 40 meters, if it's a 40-meter dipole and you're feeding it on 80 meters, yes, you can get a huge viswap. But if it's the right length approximately to get an extremely high viswap outside of the range of the antenna tuner, very unusual. Back to you, Jeff, and let's see what brand name that was. WA2RAS, K2RIW in the TechNet. So, let's...
Okay, K2RIW, WA2RAS. I can't tell you what the brand name was. I remember, I think I bought it from, it was either MFJ or, I think it was MFJ. I bought it, I know, I bought it from, I think I bought it from HRO. And the second one, I bought at a Weimar Campfest from, I don't know the guy, but if you mentioned the name, he's one of the two guys that's at almost every Hamfest, selling antennas and blog books and things like that. But I don't remember the brand name. I'm sure I cut the dipole accurately. I have dipoles for every band, and they all work great. And they're all resonant exactly where I want them to. So I'm pretty good at handling a ruler. It is off a gutter. As a matter of fact, that's where the feed point is. At a gutter, on the roof. But let me just say this: it works great. The 40 meter dipole. With the ballon in the wrong place, it works terrifically. K2RIW, WA2RAS.
Okay, great checking.
Okay, you did say for the first time that it's a 40 meter dipole. If you said that earlier, I didn't catch that. And was that dipole approximately 67 feet long end to end? Jeff, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. I cut it for to right in the middle of the 40 meter band. And as I say, I also at the same time I put up dipoles for 80 and 20 and 15 and 10. And they all work, with no problems and no ballon. It's only the 40-meter dipole, which is the inverted V, that this peculiar situation arose with, Dick. Go ahead.
And one last question, Jeff. You did say it was at the gutter or at the downspout. Yeah, at the gutter or downspout. What does that mean? Was it hung from the gutter, or either piece of wire parallel to the gutter, in very close proximity to the gutter, possibly with the wind blowing, touching the gutter? Give us a couple of words on what you mean it was at the gutter, Jeff. W2RAS, K2RAW.
Late second.
Okay. It's an inverted V. The feed point is at the edge of the roof, which is a gutter. It's attached, as I recall. There's a Budwig up there, and it's attached to the butter, but the gutter. But it's not touching the gutter. I mean, it's shielded. There's all kinds of insulation around it. The dipole is not touching the gutter. I mean, you can visually see that. And then the two legs of the dipole come down. In a V pattern. So the apex is like 25 feet up, and at the low point it's about 10 feet or 9 feet or something like that, Nick. Go ahead.
Check-in, late check-in.
Jeff, what was the distance between transmission line and gutter, left-hand side of dipole and gutter, right-hand side of dipole and gutter? What was the closest distance to the gutter at the feed point, at the top of the V, and were the wires, were either of the wires parallel to a gutter? So what's the closest distance to the gutter, Jeff? To V2LAS, K2LAW?
Well, the feed point is very, very close to the gutter. The feed point is maybe 2 inches from the gutter. It is not the antenna. No part of the antenna is parallel to the gutter. It would be perpendicular almost. To the gutter, because the gutter is at the high point of the antenna, and the antenna, it's the V, it's coming down from there. But does that answer the question, Dick?
I'm trying to get a mental picture of what's going on at the V point. 2 inches was the mechanical support for the center of the inverted V. Was it hanging from the gutter, or was it hanging from the wood of the house alongside of the gutter, but the spacing was only 2 inches to the gutter? It does sound awfully close, and I'm having trouble picturing what's the relationship between gutter and all of the hardware of the antenna, and what is it being suspended from. There may be a factor here. Over to you, Jeff, K2LIW.
Well, as I recall, I put it up years ago. They have those, in the gutter, there are those little support things that go over the over the gutter, and I think that's what the center connector, the Budwig, is attached to, and I believe that's what's holding it up. But obviously, what's holding it up is nylon cord. Nothing that would conduct. Dick, does that help?
If the antenna was suspended by a nylon cord and portions of the antenna are 2 inches from the gutter, are you telling me this piece of nylon cord that's attached to the gutter support system, are you telling me that piece of nylon cord is 2 inches long? Over to you, Jeff, KQRIW.
I think that is what I'm telling you. It's obviously it's held in place because you've got the two legs attached at the bottom, so that's forming the V. Dick, go ahead.
Was there a egg insulator or a plastic insulator? What was in the center of the dipole? Mechanically, how was the coax cable connected to the inverted V?